Thanks a lot, and thanks to the organizers for having me. I guess my talk is an echo of this morning's set of talks, and after that we'll be done with echoes. I also have to apologize for those who saw me give a similar talk to this in the summer here at PI. This is a shorter duration echo of that talk, but I think there are a lot of new faces in the audience. So yeah, I'm going to be talking about a recipe for echoes, meaning a way of sort of generating echo predictions, which along the way I think also helps develop a lot of intuition for what kinds of phenomenology you might expect to see in some kind of echo waveform, and hopefully a tool therefore to develop some templates if one wants to do a templated search for echoes in real data. I have to first and foremost mention this is work done with collaborators at Caltech. Zach Mark is a student at Caltech who led this project. Yanbei Chen is his advisor, and another student, Song Ming, also participated in the analysis. So going forward, the talks from this morning really nicely already introduced the subject here. The modes of extremely compact exotic objects have been studied for a very long time, but this whole field was sort of refreshed and revisited starting with this paper by Vidor and Paolo and their collaborators in a series of papers. The main thrust of those papers was to point out that in the wake of GW150914, where we think we have evidence maybe for a ring down, having ring down doesn't necessarily guarantee the black hole nature of an object. That in fact, these exotic compact objects can have a quasi-neural mode-like emission. But they come together with that emission comes an extra thing, these echoes, these additional pulsations, which sort of change in amplitude and duration over time, but repeat afterward. And we've talked about why this happens a little bit. As a total outsider to sort of the modified gravity community, for me, I never really have any sense of what's a compelling theory to work on, and so therefore I kind of avoid doing anything. What makes echoes interesting for me is it's a nice example of a generic effect that holds across many different cases and many different theories of compact objects, which means it's something that you might try to see if you can constrain using data. Now, the idea of this recipe in these echo models is as follows. You're solving basically wave equations around black holes. And when you do that, you boil the problem down in the frequency domain to solving ordinary differential equations, which tell you how the harmonics of a given field evolve. And it really looks exactly like solving a time-independent Schrodinger equation like you did in undergraduate courses, with some region where the waves propagate freely left and right of some potential. And of course, the black hole is what gives this potential. It's a combination of the gravitational attraction of the black hole and the angular momentum barrier of the given harmonic of a wave that you're looking at. And the thing that's actually totally unique about black holes is that when we stretch out our coordinate system using this tortoise coordinate, r star, I'm going to be calling it x, which makes the region around the horizon stretched out to an infinite distance, you actually have two zones of free propagation, one near infinity and one close to the black hole. This is totally different than any other object. If you scatter waves off of any object but a black hole, there's inevitably an angular momentum barrier at the origin, which causes reflection of the waves. The thing that's unique about black holes and wormholes, these objects that you can sort of go through, is that this can go on forever. And so that's a boundary condition you set here in solving the wave equations. For very compact objects, you have a situation where outside of that compact object, you imagine that the space-time looks exactly like Schwarzschild. Of course, the space-time is different inside the object, but outside, we're working in spherical symmetry, so this really is the Schwarzschild metric. If the object is sufficiently compact, then this whole potential picture outside the black hole is unaffected. And you really have this nice zone of free propagation to the left of the barrier, but something has to change. Now that we have an exotic compact object, the waves just don't disappear down a black hole horizon. Instead, they're going to go into the object, interact with it in some way, and come back out. And so we can parameterize any compact object we want to whatsoever by simply changing the boundary condition here. And the generic thing you can do is that instead of having waves that propagate into the object, you can also have some reflection. And this reflection can be frequency dependent, right? So different frequencies can be delayed by different amounts as they pass through the object. The simplest model would be just a perfectly reflecting wall, like a Planck length outside the horizon, right? So we end up with a two-parameter model for our exotic compact object. we have to put the surface of the object somewhere, x naught. Our only restriction is that this x naught be close to the horizon, so there's a lot of distance in between the scattering peak and the boundary. And we have some functional degree of freedom here, the reflectivity as a function of frequency. And we now replace the boundary condition, instead of waves going only to the left, we replace this with waves which can come to the right after being reflected, and waves that are going in to the compact object. And this is a really trivial thing to do. You can always do this. If you had a particular model for your compact object, actually calculating this might be really, really hard. But formally, we can do this. And it turns out that this formal manipulation tells you a lot. And I'm going to talk about that. But first, just as a matter of terminology, I'm going to be talking about the black hole's reflection and transmission. And I use an opposite convention to what people normally do. Normally, you're talking about reflection and transmission as viewed from infinity. Here, I'm going to be talking about waves that are going to be impinging on the black hole's effective potential from the left. So things that reflect, it's the reflection off of the inside of this barrier, and waves that transmit, I'm going to be talking about the transmission through the barrier. So that's just a matter of convention.
What is
F is 1 minus 2m over r. Okay. It's just a convenient way of parameterizing it. Any other questions so far, by the way? OK. Please stop me and ask questions. I don't care if I get to the end of my talk, although maybe you do. Good. So I was going to get to rotation at the end. Rotation can very much change this picture. But to start building a qualitative model, we begin with just Schwarzschild. But that's a very important thing to keep in mind. Everything I'm going to be talking about is spherically symmetric non-rotating objects. So this simple trick of replacing the black hole with a boundary condition actually allows you to construct a radial Green function. So the Green function tells you, given a pulse, how the waves propagate through spacetime and are picked up somewhere else. And it turns out that by changing the boundary conditions, you can actually calculate this very trivially and write it down in sort of a factorized form where there's a piece, which is just the usual Green function in a black hole spacetime, plus some modification, which is coming from the fact that you've got this reflecting boundary. Because there's a piece of this which is just the regular black hole Green function and a piece that's different, you can show that the waves you would read off at infinity, this is a Penrose diagram I've drawn here, we've got some signal you're reading off from infinity due to some sources in the spacetime. The signal you read off from infinity is the exact same signal you would have gotten for a given source or initial data in a black hole spacetime, that comes from this piece, plus a transfer function times the amplitude of the waves that would have actually reached the black hole horizon. Okay? So now we have a picture, an intuitive picture for what's going on with echoes. And this is what we've already talked about before. You've got the main event, something happens in the spacetime and gives you a signal at infinity. And then what happens is the waves propagate, and it's the waves that impinge on the horizon, or would have impinged on the horizon, that are transformed into echoes you see at infinity. You can calculate this transfer function. It has this form if you want to write it down compactly, but you get a lot more intuition by expanding the denominator in a geometric series, because all of a sudden you realize that the transfer function's effect are to take this signal on the horizon and reprocess it into a whole sum of terms. Okay? There's always a factor in this transfer function which comes from transmission back through the effective potential. There's always going to be a term here which comes from reflection from the surface of our compact object near the horizon. And then there's a whole sum of terms. And each successive term represents an additional process whereby a wave packet could reflect off the inside of the effective potential, reflect one more time from the surface of our object, and arrive at infinity. And this is why you get a sequence of echoes. Each one of them has an additional phase shift, and you can have additional phase shifts due to the reflectivity at the surface of the object if this is frequency dependent.
So by writing down that Green function, have you assumed that this reflecting surface is sufficiently far away from the potential barrier?
Yes. So that was what I talked about here. Our primary assumption is that there has to be this region of free propagation here. And so, but of course, if you're thinking about Planck scale effects or even surfaces which are large compared to the Planck scale but still very close to the horizon, it's easy to put this at a place where that's not a problem. But that's something one could investigate going forward. So this is our intuition and this is our tool now, right? Given any signal, I can actually evolve on a regular black hole spacetime. I can read off the data of the waves that would have hit the horizon, the waves that would have hit infinity. I can have you give me your favorite echo model, by which I mean some position for the barrier and some frequency-dependent reflectivity, and I can just spit out the echoes you'll see. Okay, so this model also allows you to develop some intuition for why these echoes look the way they do. And you can figure this out by investigating the transfer function. And that transfer function has some universal properties which shape the echoes, no matter what your sources are. And that's also a powerful thing to think about. So the transfer function is some combination of the reflection and transmission from the object, right? But it's also reflection and transmission through the effective potential. So the reflection from the effective potential is effectively a low-pass filter, the transmission function is the opposite. It's a high-pass filter. So high-frequency waves have an easier time getting out back into the main space-time. The very first echo only has to reflect off the horizon and transmit through the barrier. So it only gets hit with the high-pass filter. So that first echo is special. But each subsequent echo also gets hit by the reflection from the inside of the barrier and gets hit by this low-pass filter. And the effect overall is a band-pass filter. So starting with the second echo, everything is band-pass filtered. And they're all band-pass filtered with a filter centered somewhere around the black hole's quasi-neural mode frequency. So you're cleaning out a lot of the frequencies that aren't close to the quasi-neural mode frequency. And the successive echoes do slowly drift down towards lower and lower frequencies. Okay? So this is what looking at these transfer functions look like in the frequency domain and the time domain. You would be convolving these transfer functions look like this. They're these, you know, sort of sine Gaussian looking things. The early ones are kind of tight. The later ones begin to sort of look universal. They spread out over time. They decrease in amplitude actually very slowly. I think they decrease in amplitude effectively with this 1/log effect that the decay of the normal modes of the object itself have. So eventually, these successive echoes keep getting hit with the same kind of transfer function, and things sort of start to look the same. So the transfer function is only half the picture. You also have to then feed in your favorite source. If you, for instance, throw in a plunging particle in a black hole spacetime, you can then reprocess that through our procedure. So here, if the barrier is placed 5 × 10⁻¹² a Schwarzschild radii away from the horizon, this is the echo chain you get. Okay, so we've got the main emission from the plunge. This first echo is special. It doesn't get hit by the transfer function in quite the same way. And then after that, you get the chain of echoes that over time broaden out, decrease in amplitude slowly until finally they begin to blend together. If you put the surface further away from the horizon, as we've already heard, the spacing between these successive echoes gets smaller. They blend together much more quickly, and it's harder to see a distinct chain of echoes. You instead sort of see something a little messier pretty quickly. That was an example, by the way, for just a constant reflectivity. If you do as Vitor and colleagues did in their first paper, think about a wormhole. A wormhole can actually be modeled as a reflectivity 1 compact object. You just skip every other echo, it turns out, and you can look at the paper to see why that happens. So you end up with a very similar picture with the spacing a little wider. But this is just two examples of compact objects you could get echoes out this way. All right. Our picture also gives you some insight in how to transition in between this echoing picture and the actual fundamental modes of the object. These quasi-neural modes, they're not the fundamental modes of any of these compact objects. They're not resonances in that green function I showed you. And by investigating our model and moving the barrier further away, you begin to see how they blend together into a very long-lived ringing at just the object's own fundamental mode. So that's another interesting thing. But I'm not going to talk about it too much because I think I'm running out of time. Instead, I'm going to say what the intuition can do for you out there who maybe wants to think about looking for echoes. What this tells us, as I said, is that the echo's transfer function is like a bandpass filter on the quasi-neural mode frequency. What that means is that maybe a very generic model is to not model a full signal and then do this recipe I've told you about, but just take a simple quasi-neural mode ringing. So we imagine now, what is the signal on the horizon if we just had a single quasi-neural mode at the black hole's fundamental frequency ringing along? This is going to be the most important contribution to the echoes at sort of a middle time. And you can go ahead and reprocess that. So for instance, here's what the entire signal on the horizon looks like from our plunge model. And here's what just the, I think, yeah, maybe I got that wrong. Anyway, so we've done this. So what we did was we took our model of having a plunging particle with a full signal on the horizon. We reprocessed to get its echoes. And we also attempt to use just this simple model for a ringing on the horizon. And we reprocess that using our model.
So omega capital omega plus and minus.
Yeah, that's the positive and negative frequency, real part of the frequency of the quasi-neural mode. So that's just the fundamental quasi-neural mode of the black hole. Good question. Any other questions? So the other things about this model I didn't mention, we go ahead and we fold the Lorentzian of our quasi-neural mode ringing with some Gaussian envelope just so that it turns on and off. So you excite the mode for a certain amount of time and then let it ring freely. That's what this Gaussian is doing. So taking this model, we can develop a template. The template has several free parameters. It's effectively got the strength and the phase of our quasi-neural modes, the amount of time over which we excite it, and some time in which we decide the ringing starts. And we also have our plunge model. And we can actually do an overlap of these two things and see how well our simple quasi-neural mode model does at reproducing an actual plunge echo waveform. And the answer is that, you know, you fix some constant R, so we've got reflectivities between 0 and 1, and we have some fixed placement of the surface of the object from something which is actually not very close to the black hole horizon at the end of the day to something which is quite close to black hole horizon. And we can see how well we perform. And the answer is that by maximizing over just these few parameters, we can always perform really well. We get very high overlaps. It turns out there's some difficulties we have at very large reflectivities. That's because when your reflectivity is very large, it turns out that the power in the lowest frequencies do matter, and our quasi-neural mode template only correctly captures the powers in the mid-frequencies. So that's a detail we can talk about later. The main story here, though, is that the quasi-normal mode ringing on the horizon, not at infinity, that's the thing that gets reprocessed and generates the bulk of the signal you see in echoes. Okay.
Is this something that includes LIGO noise in it, or is this talk about overlap?
No, this is overlap zero flat noise curve, zero noise. Very, very just multiplying the signals together and doing the integral. Yeah. This story will change, but this is sort of gives you an upper bound on what you can get. Yeah, so Vitor's telling me I have no time left. So I was going to try to make sure I spent plenty of time on the shortcomings of this model, because there's a lot of shortcomings. First of all, we're talking about a non-rotating model. So this is fairly trivial to extend to scalar fields in Kerr, but you do expect some interesting phenomenology to arise. For example, Paolo already mentioned this morning about the possibility of superradiant instabilities when you add one of these reflecting barriers. That may not be so bad, because just a little bit of absorption at that barrier can quench these instabilities. This is this work by Maggio et al. But this is the next step to do, would be to investigate how this same model performs and what kind of interesting phenomena you get when the black hole is spinning.
Question?
Yes.
Here, you assume that it's curved, so you fix the surface at proper...
So here we're fixing the surface. So what we're doing is, of course, we're just working in Schwarzschild coordinates and fixing it at some spherical surface. In Kerr, I think this, where you fix the surface, becomes a bit more difficult, right? Because you might, for the easiest thing to do would be to fix it at a certain radius in like Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, say. But what does that have to do with anything, right? Well, that's something that's a little bit tricky. You might consider setting the barrier at different places for different azimuthal harmonics, which I think would be an effective way to put the barrier and still have the barrier in some vague sense be theta dependent, because the different waves might probe it differently. But that's something to be investigated.
So you don't know how this affects the signal? I mean, how strongly?
No, I mean, what you would do is you'd have to have some profile, some R theta boundary conditions, which is going to be more complicated to actually implement. But I think for a first pass, you would still just place at a constant R, because that's where the equations are going to separate in a way that's simple, and you can study it and really get the same exact picture.
But you're not putting it at constant proper distance away from it.
No, you don't put it. You could investigate doing that, but that's not what you would be doing.
Rotating at a constant potential.
Yeah, if you put it at a constant proper distance, you're not going to separate. That's not going to be a separable kind of a problem.
Right.
And you, I mean, it makes very little difference because it all goes into the logarithm, right? If you change the distance.
I think that's exactly right. These small details hopefully are not important, but you need to investigate. That's not the biggest problem. Let me at least try to tell you the biggest problem before I get kicked off stage. The biggest problem is that this simple reflecting boundary picture is not so good for gravitational waves. It should guide our intuition. Everything I've just said should hold for gravitational waves. But implementing it in detail suffers from some technical challenges when it comes to gravitational waves. And the reason is that it can be difficult to implement the boundary conditions on the simple scalar wave equations we can actually separate and work with in Kerr. Right? So as an example, Price and Khanna pointed out that let's say we wanted to have a reflecting barrier for electromagnetic waves. Well, we know how to phrase reflecting boundary conditions in terms of the actual electric fields, but that involves actually placing some non-trivial boundary conditions on complex scalar fields that are what you actually want to evolve with the wave equations. So you end up with pretty complicated boundary conditions that begin to couple multiple ordinary differential equations together. The picture is not yet worked out for the gravitational wave case. You expect it to be a lot more complicated. I still think it should be doable, but some thought needs to go into this. It's not clear that the simple reflecting boundary picture is going to work well for gravitational waves. So that's an open line of investigation. The last thing I want to say, the most important thing I want to say, everything that you've heard about echoes so far, including everything I've said, is really focusing on this paradigm of evolving test fields in a fixed background, right? So that might be appropriate if you're imagining Emery situations, where a particle is small and the space-time really is this fixed exotic compact object. When we're talking about crashing two exotic compact objects together to make the kinds of signals that LIGO is seeing, it is an open question whether you'll really see a clean echo signature or whether you're going to just see some mess and then some really long-lived quasi-neural mode ringing like you do in a neutron star post-merger kind of a ringing. And I think the only thing that's been done so far to my knowledge, and please correct me because I'm sure this has been very active, as mentioned this morning, boson stars have been collided, and the result is not necessarily a clean echo, right? The post-merger emission can be messy, and it's not clear that this echo picture is going to hold up when we finally get around to merging comparable mass objects in a fully non-linear system. So what does that mean? That means people have to do full numerical simulations. This is incredibly hard, as people in this room can tell you. People are working on it right now and will present results, I think, later in this conference. But this is the future. And hold on, like, make sure the echo picture really carries through when we start to do these things. All right.
Is it just hard, or is it simply that you don't know how to do it?
Both. Right? I mean, no. So we know how to evolve Einstein's equations. So in principle, you could imagine with some work, you could evolve slightly more complicated equations. You can evolve more fields. That can all be done. We can do fluid equations in full GR.
What I mean is that if you don't have a dynamical model of the echo,
that's what you don't know, right? So first of all, what is the full model that gives you a given compact object? Second of all, can you state that model, that Lagrangian, as an initial value problem that's well posed? Because if you can't do that, you're in trouble. Luis, for instance, has done some work about this and showing how you can try to take effective field theory Lagrangians, which are not well posed, and try to turn them into well posed systems. This is a very challenging and complicated thing to do. And you're totally right that imagining something like a gravistar, what is the Lagrangian that generates gravistars? I have no idea. But without that, you're not going to be able to evolve them, right, and have them collide. So this is really a challenge in many ways. Yeah. All right, that's all I'm going to say. Thank you.
Comment just on this line here. So for this configuration that we were considering, the radius of a boson star is about the light ring location.
Yeah.
So we're not expecting that.
Yeah, and when they're more compact, they turn into black holes anyway, right? So boson stars are not promising sources for echoes for these reasons. But they're all that can be done. Yes?
In your highly simplified model, right, I mean, gravitational wave burst comes out. Is there a timing delay?
Yeah, absolutely. So as has been mentioned before, There's two delay scales here. There's the delay between the burst and the first echo, and this is a bit more complicated, and that's because, like I said, this is really the stuff that impinges on the horizon, and the timing here really does not necessarily have a lot to do with when this burst happens. I mean, it does in an indirect way because both of these two bursts are being sourced by the same object, but this is not an echo of this burst. This is an echo of the stuff hitting the horizon. The successive echoes, though, are evenly spaced by the travel time around that cavity between the effective potential and the surface of the object. So as has been pointed out, this should be a constant. Of course, these are spreading out, so it's harder to identify their centers, but basically the spacing between the centers should be a constant.
The time to bounce in and out or the orbital time around?
This comes from the time it takes the waves themselves to propagate in the cavity. Yeah.
Isn't that all going to get messed up? I mean, I suppose we have two black holes collecting.
Absolutely.
For the accretion disks, right?
Well, so the black holes we don't think are going to have material around them. Like for instance, the black hole, you know, GW1509 and 14. How do we know it was black holes? Well, maybe we don't, although black holes fit the picture really well and they're very simple. But there's no reason to think that if those were two compact objects, we would get a clean echo signature as opposed to this kind of thing, which would have been my initial expectation, a very long-lived emission at the fundamental modes of that object, right? And this carries that logarithmic imprint by the fact that the decay is sort of logarithmic with the distance from the thing. But this is very different. This is not an echo, and it would not be mistaken for normal quasi-neural mode ringing. So. Yeah, we would know that, we would see that, yeah.
A simple-minded question. We're trying to decide whether a compact object has a horizon.
Yeah.
So we can picture a case where you don't see echoes because the black hole is not strictly black.
Mm-hmm.
It's gray.
So sure.
The frequency of the horizon is not infinite, it's finite, but very large. So we can never decide upon horizons existing or not for this method. It's important that there's a little bit of leakage of some emission.
You have to, for this to work, the idea is that, right, if the black hole's not black, there's some modification to the quasi-neural ringing. That's always been the paradigm. What's new here is whether you think about this as a modification to the frequencies or by the energy that would have gone down to the black hole reflecting back out in a very particular way. But regardless, you can still think of it as saying that to the extent to which we can measure the ring down in some way or another, that's going to tell you how much that object looks like a black hole. And there's always going to be a limit to that. There's always going to be a limit to that, right? I mean, you can always bring the surface closer, make the echo last longer, damp it more.
Okay, I think one very good question and answer.
So, if I understand, the conclusion is if you have a spiral black hole, everything goes through, you get echoes. If you have a curved black hole with considerable spin, you probably get echoes,
yes.
But the details haven't been worked out.
Yes.
If you have two objects that are coming together and merging,
it's possible.
There's no echoes.
Yes, I think that's true. Until someone does a simulation that shows echoes from two comparable mass objects, I think you can't be sure, and I don't think there's a clear reason to show that that would be true, right? But it is possible.
Well, it's fine to... Yeah.
So you please disagree with me, because I think maybe here our opinions differ a lot.
If you do have a central discussion...
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is the biggest... Your question is the biggest unknown in my eyes. Yeah, all right,
thank you.
Thank you
very much.